Now, In Depth with Francis Rose.
Thanks for listening on Friday, October 10th, 2014. It's the Federal News Countdown, the three most important federal news stories of the week. Every week, two experts in the world of the federal government choose the news stories they think are most important to people who work for the federal government. They rank them in order, and we count them down on the Federal News Countdown. This week, my experts in the world of the federal government are Mike Hettinger. It's great to see you. Thank you for coming in, Mike.
Thanks for having me on, Francis.
Happy to do it. It's your first time, so welcome to the Federal News Countdown.
Thanks for having me.
Happy to do it. And a vet of the Federal News Countdown is Jeff Cook. It's good to see you as always, my friend.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in, and happy to have you on the program as always. We start the Federal News Countdown where we always do with...
Number three!
And Mike Hettinger, your third most important federal news story of the week is from FedScoop. The headline is the HP split, what it means for federal tech programs. And because it's splitting in the way that it's splitting, Mike, it seems to me that I guess what it means depends on where you sit in government,
well,
right?
Well, I think what it means depends on not only where you sit, but how this thing shakes out here over the next 12 months or so, because, you know, I'm not sure we know what the impact is necessarily at this point, but they're splitting into two separate business units, and those are two separate businesses. Those two businesses have essentially operated as separate business units for a number of years. So there clearly will be an impact. I think it will take some time to see exactly what that impact is. But, you know, we're talking about a major government contractor here. You know, HP, about $4 billion in federal government revenue. That ranks them number six on the WashTech 100 list of the top government contractors. So clearly there will be a significant impact as this plays out.
I may be oversimplifying it, but my takeaway from the coverage of this was essentially they're taking their services business and their products business and they're separating them in two.
That's right.
And you're going to be able to buy printers and hardware and so on and supplies from one company.
That's right.
And you're going to be able to buy your consulting services and so on from a separate part of that.
That's right. And I'm not exactly sure what the revenue split is between the two entities, but you know, the public sector piece, the enterprise, you know, the cloud, the software, the services side of the HP business is what is the enterprise side of it. So that will be the services business. The hardware is obviously the laptops and the you know, PCs and whatever else they sell, printers and that sort of thing. So we'll see how that split works out, and how their overall revenue and whatnot is impacted. Interestingly, I think, you know, we're seeing a lot of spinoffs lately in the tech space, between the eBay spinning off, you know, PayPal. Mm-hmm. We heard today that Symantec is going to split as well. So, you know, there's a lot going on. And of course, last year, SAIC split into two companies with SAIC and Leidos coming out from that split. So it's an interesting time, I think, in the federal marketplace.
And this didn't really surprise anybody for the reasons that you mentioned about what the scope of the landscape of the marketplace looks like. But this is something that has been rumored and talked about and there's been buzz about HP specifically.
That's right.
For a number of years, some type of restructuring.
That's
not
right.
Necessarily this mechanism, but
in
them
part,
doing something.
Yeah, in part because they were operating as two separate units within HP.
Mm-hmm.
I think folks were looking at it and saying, you know, there's got to be some movement here to try to separate these two entities and look at it from a services and a hardware standpoint. So, yeah, this is really just moving forward with something that I think folks expected for a while.
And another part of this that I think we should keep in the backs of our minds is this is the same kind of questioning and hand-wringing that we thought about when HP and Compaq merged a number of years ago. And if you look back at and go back to maybe 3 or 4 years after that merger happened, the general consensus, at least in the federal marketplace, seemed to be it didn't really matter that
right.
much one way or the other.
Right.
You were still able to get what you needed.
Well, and yeah, I think part of why it's my number three story for the week is we're not quite sure what's going to happen,
mm-hmm.
right? And as the federal market changes, you know, and we begin to see different companies playing in different areas of the marketplace, you know, this could have a potentially a very large impact on the federal space, or could have very little. So I think as it plays out over the next, 12, 15, 18 months, we'll have a better sense of whether it's the number three story or maybe the number one story.
Mike Hettinger's choice for the third most important federal news story of the week's from FedScoop. The headline is the HP split, what it means for federal tech programs. Jeff Cook, your choice at number three is my colleague Jason Miller's story. White House now thinks smaller is better for cyber bills. And I don't mean this as a wrap on the White House. It's just kind of a look at the realism of the legislative process. But, and it's encouraging that they're going here now, I think. But I guess the question is what took them so long, because it's been obvious for a long time that we weren't going to get a huge, major, gigantic cyber bill for a while now.
Well, and the question is, did you need a huge, enormous cyber bill?
Mm-hmm.
There are two aspects to this. What are we doing in the federal space, and what is being done in the commercial, non-federal, non-governmental space?
Mm-hmm.
There's a comment that these bills are, I think it says, unlikely to pass. I think that's an understatement. There's zero chance of these things being attached to the omnibus or working their way through in the lame duck Congress. But that said, it expresses a sense of the White House that they would like to see something done to address a few areas. There was a comment made by Michael Daniel that he wanted to get rid of passwords and thought they were weak. And it was funny, other news outlets, that's all they picked up on, is Michael Daniels wants you to get rid of passwords. I thought Jason did a nice job here of tying in also the existing initiatives and policies, HSPD 12 and the NSTIC, for identity management. I think Jason also made a good point there's been a push for workforce training by the White House to increase the number of experts in cybersecurity. In this article, Jason points out that following the Target breach, members of the Target board of directors are facing recall, and I guess the CIO has been removed.
Mm-hmm.
And my thought was that sort of pressure, market pressures, are going to be a lot more effective than any legislation that would ever pass.
Yeah, for two reasons. I mean, whoever comes in after them, of course, will know that that's priority one, 1A, and 2, and 2A. And the other issue is, if you're sitting on the board at Walmart or any other major retailer, you're paying attention to that too, if you like having that director gig.
Yeah, if you're wearing a dead man's boots, you know it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Jeff Cook's choice for the third most important federal news story of the week is from federalnewsradio.com. The headline is White House Now Thinks Smaller is Better for Cyber Bills, and you can read Jason's coverage and all the stories on this week's countdown linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. When we come back, the second most important federal news stories of the week on In Depth with Francis Rose. Welcome back to the Federal News Countdown on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. The three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected this week by Jeff Cook and Mike Hettinger, and we're up to
number two.
Mike, your second most important federal news story of the week is from NextGov, and the headline is not particularly complimentary. The headline is HHS debuts new and improved healthcare.gov. The back button now works.
That's right. Now, it does. Apparently, I have not been on myself, but apparently the back button on the new healthcare.gov is functioning properly.
That's hard to consider a real coup for the companies who came in after CGI and apparently had a whole lot of work to do. I will say we're now 10 days into the second round of open season, and we certainly haven't heard anything near like we heard last October about problems with healthcare.gov.
Right, and so with healthcare.gov, the open enrollment is actually November 15th,
We'll
begin to, I think we'll really have the test point on November 15th when we start to see re-enrollments and new users try to get on. That'll be the real test as to whether, beyond the back button, this thing is functioning in a way that will allow folks to register, get what they need to get and move forward. We joke about the back button, but I kind of picked the story, to be quite honest with you, because of the headline. And reading the story and looking at the the information that came along with it. I mean, in the old system, if you hit back, you went all the way back to the beginning. So all the work that you had done, all the work that you had done to load your information, everything else potentially got wiped out. And we all know how frustrating that can be. So, there's some other improvements. They've got it down, the application down from 78 screens down to 16, except in special cases where you still have to do the longer application. Mm-hmm. I mean, all of those things tell me that we're moving in the right direction. A lot of testing for this phase of it, this rollout, I think will be done in advance as opposed to on the fly like it was back last year. So hopefully we see some major improvements in functionality.
Jeff, the encouraging thing that I see here is apparently a better understanding by the people who are talking about it about what it all means. I remember one particular incident when the system was overwhelmed at the beginning, and somebody asked Secretary Sebelius, what are you doing about it? And she said, well, we're adding more servers to be able to handle this capacity. Well, the federal IT geek in me said, well, I can't believe you didn't build this in the cloud. And I'm not suggesting that she wasn't being honest. I'm just suggesting that there was maybe a lack of clarity about how you go about explaining what was going on here. It sounds like that part of it is something that they've made a lot of effort to do, to be able to explain, not only to improve it, but to explain how it's been improved so that people can understand it.
Right. Well, I think part of what we've seen is an attitude change, or at least a better understanding. Last spring, when the House Government Reform Committee held its hearings, prior to that, there had been a comment made by one of the senior political appointees at HHS, who, when questioned about problems with the website, responded that those were staff decisions. I was occupied with higher level thinking, not realizing that having an IT system that implements the president's highest priority is indeed important. Mm-hmm. It is not beneath leadership to take an interest in the actual implementation of the plan. And I think now people have realized that is important, the functionality, how things work. You don't have to be a technical wizard to understand these things at a functionality level. And good IT managers can translate it into business speak for managers who are not technical. And similarly, managers who are not technical can make an effort to learn something about the systems. And I think that change in attitude is going to be healthy across the board, because people now, senior managers in both industry and government understand that these things are important and that it is part of their role to make that work.
Mike, you mentioned something that is my favorite piece of information from this story that has to be a head slapper for program managers across government. You said the online application, as this story quotes, has been whittled down from 78 screens to just 16.
Right.
Now, it's good that they've done that. It's good that they've made that progress. But I'm having a hard time imagining any program manager that goes, yeah, this is a really good idea to have 78 screens that people have to go through. What could possibly go wrong?
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, and I'm not sure I'd heard that. I
had
a lot of attention
either
to the whole healthcare.gov rollout last year. I don't think I'd ever heard the 78 screens. We knew it was complicated,
mm-hmm.
and I'll be honest, to me, this stuff is complicated, right? And Jeff knows that, and you know that from the folks that you talk to. I mean, you've got a lot of feeder systems. You've got a lot of interfaces that have to take place. This was not a website to slap up and something easy to do, and it has worked fairly effectively for the last few months. But yeah, 78 screens at the outset, a back button that takes you all the way back. I mean, these are basic functionalities that you would have thought would be in there, right from the outset.
A lot of those systems interfaces, though, I mean, this is a problem of their own making. The system did not have to be that complicated. The president did not promise a system that was interfaced to all these other systems. The president promised that you could go online and find your insurance, and that could have been as simple as a couple of documents, a PDF or something that where you could where you could compare prices.
That's right, but it's more fun to make it complex.
That was it. It was a problem of their own making.
Right.
Mike Hettinger's second most important federal news story of the week's from NextGov. The headline is HHS debuts new and improved healthcare.gov. The back button now works, and you can find that and all of our stories linked later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Jeff, your second most important story of the week is you get man crush on Jason Miller this week.
Another Miller story. If Jason doesn't report it, it's not important.
Another Miller story from federalnewsradio.com. VA begins process to remove executive at the center of the FedBid scandal. I thought this was important for two reasons, and tell me if this, either of these two are the reason you chose this. The first reason I thought this was important is because it's the first case of VA being able to remove an SESer according to the power of the law that President Obama signed recently. And the second reason is it doesn't have anything to do with the scheduling scandal or anything to do with any of the VA health locations. It's a completely separate issue.
You're exactly correct on both of those points.
I'm sorry I stole your thunder.
No. It's exactly correct. I wonder if when Congress passed that law and the president signed it, if they had any idea that they would be test firing it quite this quickly. I know the Merit System Protection Board has an interim rule out on this. They've never done this before. You know, there are procedures in place that the VA is supposed to notify the NSPB immediately so that they can free up an administrative law judge to hear the case. So it's interesting from that standpoint. And it is completely separate from the other problems that VA has had. I think the other thing that I thought this story is going to continue to make waves because of the type of scandal it was. It was a case of a procurement that was a little bit loose. People that got a little too comfortable with their in-house contractors. There's some. I don't mean to defend or condemn anybody here, but it's interesting for that aspect, and I wonder if given this outcome and the high profile of this, if it will have a chilling effect the way the conference scandal at GSA did, which we still haven't recovered from.
Yeah, there are a lot of ramifications here, Mike. And on the one hand, you could say, well, that's exactly the point of the laws, is supposed to be a deterrent. But that pendulum can swing way too far the other direction, and it could make people who are thinking about doing things that are fully within the bounds of the law decide not to do them because they just don't want to take a chance, and especially in the area of acquisition where this was.
Well, and that's right. I mean, you know, one thing that you know, I've been pushing for years is a little bit of flexibility in this process. Mm-hmm. And this is interesting because you've got an agency, you know, through the IG, through the work that was done, looking to move out as senior executive. Congress hasn't really weighed into this yet. And one of the issues that I've raised consistently is, you know, Congress needs to be responsible in its oversight to make sure that we're not unnecessarily taking out, you know, people that are doing good jobs that happen to have gotten caught up in the scandal. You know, if there's fraud and that sort of thing, obviously that will run its course through the legal process, through the IG process, et cetera. But Congress really hasn't weighed in. I mean, the chair of the VA committee, Jeff Miller, is referenced in the article that Jeff picked. It's you know, it'll be interesting to see how Congress reacts to this as we go forward. But it looks like VA is doing what it feels like it needs to do. But it does, you know, you want it to act as a deterrent, but you don't want to scare the heck out of people either.
Jeff Cook's choice for the second most important federal news story of the week is from federalnewsradio.com. The headline is VA begins process to remove executive at center of FedBid scandal. You can find that and all of our stories on this week's countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the most important federal news stories of the week is selected by Jeff Cook and Mike Hettinger. Back in a moment on Federal News Radio. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Jeff Cook and Mike Hettinger. And we are up to
number one.
The top of the chart, the most important federal news story of the week, is selected by Mike Hettingers from the Washington Business Journal. It's Jill Itoro's story. Headline, Feds pay another $14 million to buy systems from contractor mired in Chapter 11. And Jill reported, and my colleague Jason reported when it happened, that Global Computer Enterprises filed for Chapter 11 September 4th. The General Services Administration and the Labor Department spent $23 million to buy their own data back from the contractor. And the main reason is because the contract wasn't written to the benefit of the government. And your story this week demonstrates that this is happening again. So what I have to take away from this, Mike, is the first time wasn't the only time, and the second time probably isn't the only time either. And there are probably people at agencies across government that are saying, we better go look at our contracts.
Well, I think that's right. It's a technology issue to some extent, but it's really a contracting issue when you come right down to it. And the reason I picked the story is this is something that I think we're seeing more and more of in the federal government. And you noted, you know, $23 million to buy the data and the system from GCE at the Department of Labor. Now $14 million, and I guess I saw an update to the story. They actually got that price down to $9.5 million to buy FPDS.
I guess when you're in Chapter 11, you negotiate a little more.
You know that
more freely.
Yeah, I guess so. Hopefully we'll never know. But yeah, so you're talking about, you know, upwards of $30 million paid to one contractor. For essentially the rights to data that was generated in the federal government space. I find it fascinating. I think there's a lot to this story. As you mentioned, Jason Miller reported on it when it happened. He did a pretty thorough job of going through some of the issues. We've got a similar issue that's cropped up with recovery.gov just in the last couple of weeks. Around Dun & Bradstreet's ownership potentially of that data, or the interface that displays it, and these are issues that I think potentially have ramifications for contracting, cloud computing, things like that as we go down the road. So it's an important story. I think it's my number one this week, but it's something we'll continue to see, I think, over the next few months.
My colleague Tom Temin covered the issue with the DUNS numbers at federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive. Terrific conversation with the Project on Government Oversight about that issue. Jeff, I see we talked about project management earlier in the healthcare.gov story. I see some PM implications here, too, because Jill writes, both FPDS and USAspending.gov are contractor-owned systems developed, built, implemented under a contractor-owned and contractor-operated business model. I mentioned to Mike, I imagine there are a lot of people looking at their contracts, and I would bet that we don't see too many contracts like this issued in the coming years. I mean, people will get hesitant, I bet, to do that.
I would disagree on that, because a contractor-owned, contractor-operated system is the cloud. And the push to cloud computing means that they own it. You own the data, but they own the system. They own the software running it. They own the hardware. So yes, there's a bunch of these out there.
Okay, fair point. But I guess the part where you just said clarified what I was getting at, which is if you own the data and if I own data and I put it in your cloud and I still own that data, if your cloud goes bust, I can get the data back because it's mine. You have to give me back what's mine. That's the rub here, I guess, is that there was no specification. If you develop my system and you build it and you maintain it, if it's all yours, for some reason, nobody ever specified that the Labor Department owned their data and could get it back.
Well, actually, that's the Labor Department did specify that they owned their data. What they didn't have in the first contract was a clause or a price for the extraction of that data.
Okay.
And so when that first story came out, I noted I mentioned, I guess, to Jason that that if Department of Labor had asked at the outset, you know, and give us pricing to extract the data at the end of the contract, it could have been priced in at the front.
Mm-hmm.
And they just simply overlooked that. My bet is if they had priced it up front, it would have been largely the same price they got at the end, which, you know, was the cost to extract the data. Something I don't see in this story that I actually saw in a different story, I think a lot of this price that we're seeing here, they actually bought the hardware.
They bought the software. They extracted the data. So, you know, the $23 million and the $9.5 million is sort of an all-inclusive deal. But yeah, I mean, it's going to have ramifications for contracting going forward, because, you know, we have the guideline that the CAO Council put out on, you know, cloud contracts. You know, there's data ownership is something that's referenced in there, mm-hmm. but who knows, you know, behind the scenes how these contracts have been written. So we may see this pop up again and again.
Yeah,
I hope we don't, but we may.
My bet is that price is based on the value of the hardware and whatever underlying software the government did not own. It's not, I'm sure they are not selling our data to us.
I think part of it is they're selling their data back to the government. I think, and that's the issue, same issue that we're seeing with the Dunn's issue potentially. So
in Dunn's, you know, Dun & Bradstreet owns that intellectual property. So, and we basically just pay a usage fee or a rental fee. I only know that because I had oversight of Integrated Acquisition Environment for a time.
Right, right. And different variations, I think, of the same issue, which is we need to make sure going forward that we're not paying twice.
But, and that's the discussion that you're having is valuable, because I think it crystallizes exactly the reason that this story is news, because you guys are experts in this stuff. You've did this for a living, and you're not sure. You don't agree. And so the fact that multi-million dollar decisions are being made in an area where there's not a lot of clarity indicates to me, at least as an outside observer, that we're bound to see these in some form, maybe not exactly the same form as the two instances so far, but we're bound to see this come up again, because these can't be the only two contracts in the whole federal government that have been written this way.
Yes, I agree with that. And like I say, cloud computing is cloud computing, and so this is it will inevitably happen again, which brings up, I think, the more interesting policy question, which is, what are the budgeting rules right now for software as a service? Right now, we say software as a service, we're going to pay operations, we're not going to pay capital, mm-hmm. and so you pay a fee. But is that the correct way to budget for that liability? For example, right now, if you have a lease with a termination clause, budget rules say you have to budget for that termination clause. You have to make sure you've got the money to cover it just in case you do terminate. With cloud computing, there's no such rule that would say you need to be sure you got money to cover this sort of a disastrous consequence. Mm-hmm. Is there a need for change or revisitation, or how does that affect that policy? I think that's an interesting idea, because we've not seen it before.
And the same question that I have about that, what Jeff is proposing, Mike, is the same question I have about all this story more broadly, which is, you know, when the story first broke and the appearance was they're buying their own data back, there was outrage, feigned outrage, how can this be? It's the government screwing up again. I wonder if it's not a different issue, and I wonder if it's not, hey, this is a brave new world. This is a whole part of technology that we're just figuring out the rules to, and we're just figuring out the procedures to and policies to. And I don't even know if you can call it a mistake. It's an unfortunate circumstance. Right. It's something that we wish didn't happen, but I think it's unreasonable to expect everybody to think of everything in every instance.
No, and I think that's right. I don't think it was a mistake. I think it may have been an oversight. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that there was any thought given to this issue, because at the time that it was done, mm-hmm. there was no need to give a thought. We hadn't, when this was done,
yep.
I don't think any of us had ever heard the word cloud, mm-hmm. you know, and cloud was something that's new and different. And now we've got to figure out a way to address it.
Mm-hmm. Jeff, final thought.
I wonder how many people that are hesitant to shut down their systems and go to the cloud are going to cite this as the reason du jour for not doing so.
Well, that was the last thought I was going to share too, which is, I wonder what opportunity this will give people who are hesitant to do whatever to be able to justify not doing what it is they're hesitant to do. Mike Hettinger's choice of the most important federal news story of the week is from the Washington Business Journal. The headline is, Feds pay another $14 million to buy systems from contractor mired in Chapter 11. It's July Toro's story in the Business Journal, and you can find it and all of our countdown stories at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Later this afternoon, Jeff Cook's most important story of the week wraps up the Federal News Countdown next on In Depth with Francis Rose. We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories as selected by Mike Hettinger and Jeff Cook. And you did it again. Jeff Cook's most important federal news story of the week is by Jason Miller. He mows you dinner or something. I mean, he's got to come across somehow.
He is the oracle of federal news.
Please don't tell him that, because then I have to deal with him, you know, and it's just impossible. The headline is Shared Services Governance Under Development. Not a moment too soon as the push to shared services continues. But what I took away from Jason's report is that the administration wants to do everything that it can to put in place mechanisms for shared services and policies for shared services so that there's no excuse for agencies to not be able to use them anymore. And I think that's a very wise tactic.
Yeah, and it is. Having governance is one of the three elements you really need here: governance, leadership at all levels, and then mechanisms to actually move resources around. When you talk about a news story or an initiative that's going to fundamentally change the way agencies operate, the shared service initiatives have done a lot of that. There've been some successes. A number of initiatives have made a lot more progress. The travel management, for example, hit nearly 100%. But that's a small area, and when you start talking about changing the financial system under an agency, that's tied into all of their missions. You know, grants, payments to other entities, procurements, and so it's sort of like I used to say it was like heart surgery, but as I think about it more, I think it's more like a replacing your spinal column or something like that. It actually is tied into all aspects. So this is very, very hard stuff. It's not surprising that the progress is a little slower than everybody would like. But yeah, they're putting the elements in place here to allow governance. Shared decision making will bring shared responsibility, and will also bring assurances that agencies can get the service they want and not interrupt their missions delivery.
Jason writes, Treasury released two draft governance documents to gather comments from agencies and industry. The first addresses the rules for the financial management shared services marketplace. The second focuses on the federal shared service provider and customer agency relationship during the O&M phase of the system development cycle, the operations and maintenance phase. And then Jason writes, Mike, later in the story, the draft guidances don't mention industry's role or detail where they fit in this effort. I wonder if that was intentional, because obviously industry's going to say, where are we supposed to be here? And then the comment period's open. That's exactly what the comment period is for, seems to me.
Right. And this is an issue that we go through every time there's new guidance as it relates to particularly financial management shared services, is what is industry's role? Mm-hmm. And when I was at Tech America, it was something I was pushing. I mean, I've been involved in this going all the way back to 2006 when they launched the first financial management line of business. You know, there's always a question over what is that balance between industry and you know, government shared service providers. Obviously, the backbone even of the government shared service providers is industry. You know, it's commercial providers that provide the services there. But I would imagine, based on you know, my experience in this area, that the questions continue to linger. I've talked to the folks at Treasury, to Adam and to Beth, and others who've been involved in this, to try to get them to understand that you need to figure out what that role is for industry. Now, the slower they go about this, I think the more chance industry will have to have an impact on the eventual shape of this. So, you know, I've always pushed a go slow approach. I also believe shared services works in some areas, and there's some big agencies where it just may not work to shared service internally in that agency, like at DOD. Certainly, you want to try to get those economies of scale, but you know, you don't want to dump DOD on the Enterprise Service Center or something like that. It would crush under that weight. So mm-hmm. this is yet another interesting move on financial management shared services.
Are they going slowly enough, do you think?
They're going
slower. Or do we not have a sense of that
they're
yet?
They're going
maybe
slower than they have in the past, and I think they're trying to be methodical about how they approach it. You know, they're not trying to do it all at once. And back in 06, I felt like it was trying to happen all at once. Mm-hmm. but you are asking people to make investment decisions, industry folks. So we've got to be careful there that we're not leading them down a path that may change.
And that path could change as much, Jeff, because the agencies just decide to not do it as for other reasons. I mean, that's been the biggest holdup, it seems to me, that it's hard to change people's mindsets and change that idea that, well, we're the department of whatever, and so we're different than everybody else, and we can't just use the same thing somebody else is using.
Yeah, and the potential impact of making an error on the financial system, mm-hmm. you can basically shut down an agency.
Yeah.
That said, I think the OFIP, the Office of Federal Financial Innovation and Transformation, within Treasury, made a couple of good moves earlier in breaking apart financial systems. They had their electronic invoice submission, and they're looking at distributing the financial system down so that rather than having a large monolithic financial system that does everything, can you break it down by function and then outsource specific functions? That's similar to what procurement systems do. We just talked about the FPDSNG, mm-hmm. but agency contract writing systems are tied into a half a dozen external systems, like Fed BizOps and the Central Contractor Registry, that that are feeders or shared databases for those. And I think financial systems will probably end up going much the same direction, where you'll have services that then plug into a core system that handles the transactions.
So this is, as Jason reports, these are two draft governance documents. At what point in time, maybe not chronologically, but after a series of events, at what point will we be able to look back and say shared services has been successful? What are the things that has to have to happen between now and then, Jeff? With you.
They've had small limited successes, mm-hmm. like, as I said, with their electronic invoice submission system. I think a model to look at is the HR line of business, which is much narrower but is farther along because it's narrower.
Mm-hmm.
And they have guidance documents that are very similar to the two that are out here, you know, from Treasury, talking about how do customers act and how do customers interact with their providers and how does that market work. HR line of business has similar documents. In addition, then they have a document for migration guidance. Once you've picked selected a provider, how do you go there? And a continuing like an operations guide. So they are a little farther down the way, but the analogies probably hold.
What do you think this looks like at some point in the future when it's successful? What do you see? Same kind of thing, Jeff sees?
Well, I see part of that, and it depends on whether you want to break this thing down into tiny chunks or, as we've heard previously, they want to move a big agency to a shared service provider. And mm-hmm. there's been a lot of talk over the last year or so about trying to find one agency that they can sort of pick up and move their financial operations to a shared service provider, a government shared service provider. I think, and I could be wrong, but I think the OFIT and others who are involved in this think that would show some movement and some sense of success. Interestingly, and I'll say this very quickly, GCE was a shared service provider on the commercial side. Not only did they service labor, they also did EEOC, which mm-hmm. had moved from a government shared service provider to GCE. So, you know, another maybe our stories are the same this week. We just broke them up into two separate articles. But yeah, I think we need to see some significant movement on shared services.
A question here, you know, if I have six different financial systems, but I happen to be running them all in the same data center, am I sharing as much as if I take one or two functions, maybe receivables and payables, and we both actually use the same system that is then interfaced back to our home financial system? In which of those cases are we actually saving the government more money? I think sharing components fully rather than merely co-locating disparate systems is more what we're after.
And I think that's what we should be focused on. We should be thinking about how do we actually get the most bang for our buck, not let's just pick this up and move it. And that's really what we've got to see evolve over time.
Jeff Cook's most important federal news story of the week is from federalnewsradio.com. It is Jeff's chosen an all Jason Miller countdown this week. Shared services.
I love you, Jason.
Shared services governance under development is the most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Jeff Cook. Thank you very much for doing the countdown.
Thank you,
it's always
Francis.
Great to have you. Mike, welcome to the federal news countdown. You did a sufficiently good job that I'd love to have you come back and do it again.
I appreciate that. I'm glad to hear it.
I appreciate both of you being here. You can hear the entire program at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon, along with here finding links to all the stories that we counted down. The federal news countdown returns next Friday in the first hour of the program on In Depth with Francis Rose.